Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. This is, I have to admit, like a homecoming. All right, granted that I'm not a graduate of BC, but of BU, I still feel very welcome.
No.
So, and I've checked many books when I was doing my studies here, so thank you for all of that. And here are the fruits. I've done my, hopefully, jobs in the years, and here I am talking about my book, Localizing Islam in Europe, Turkish Islamic Communities in Germany and the Netherlands. This has taken, of course, years of field work with the, under the supervision of very important advisors and scholars, among them especially here, Professor White, Jenny White, and many others in this crowd. So I thank you all for your contributions in my academic life and scholarship. This question on understanding Turkish Islam, if you will, or Islam in general in Europe has been formulated, this versus question, this opposition question, which in some ways we already handled in the first panel. I think it'll continue on. As it is formulated by people I would call essentialists, is whether Islam and Europe, or Islam and the West, or Islam and modernity are compatible or incompatible. But thankfully, we have really great scholars among us who are challenging this question itself. And Berna has already started doing that with her work. And I want to really continue on that. And I see that, having sociologists, anthropologists, and political scientists together makes a nice combination to rethink this question and phrase it in the following terms. How do Muslim actors engage with liberal democracy in practice? So, we may not have philosophers or, theorists yet, but I think in practice something is cooking. And my work is really talking about that process, which is really largely a result of pragmatism, inconsistencies, and improvisations in the activism of these actors that I look in my work. And the argument that I really make is that these Islamic actors learn by doing. Very simple way, we have done it in our lives, all of us, while children in particular, but in an ongoing process. So you make mistakes, you take another step, you fall, you try, and then you get your balance. So that's the light in which I see my work, which really comprises of comparing nearly all the major Turkish Islamic organizations. Now, thankfully, Jonathan has already did a wonderful coverage of Diyanet, so I don't really have to talk in detail about that, but a very important organization that is, because it has the largest institutional frame. They have the largest number of mosques. If you, for instance, look at Germany, they have maybe close to 800 mosques. But the other organizations that I've looked into, I would argue, they are much more active on the ground. They are much more engaging. And I think new ideas are emerging. So that's the kind of stories that I'm after. The larger framework, which I will not go into the detail as I just alluded to, refers to this essentialist ideas. Well, essentialism, not only for Islam, but in general, as an approach, assumes that we can somehow access a core of an entity. And it could be a religion, it could be political ideology, whatever it is. But that's really flawed. Why is it flawed? Because it assumes that somehow if you just go to the sacred texts, and if you just look at the historical origin of a religion, you can capture those major principles, and that's it. It's really so simply misleading, though. So you can get it. That's the assumption. So when you hear, as in Kuru's presentations of Huntington or Lewis, you can see ideas that really reflect that approach. Clearly, sacred texts can be treated selectively, history, same manner. It all really depends on how people who are acting on behalf of Muslims understand those texts, and that history is really the question that we are after, especially as anthropologists, but of course largely all the scholarly community. That approach is called the contextualist approach. We try to understand the people. their lives, you know, their concerns, not just their religious identity, but their, you know, roles as brothers, sisters, parents, you know, their role, life as men, as women, as a member of a certain socioeconomic class, and on. Because those aspects will shape the way they understand their religions. Okay, and that negotiation happens especially in a very strong manner within the Islamic authorities. And there are various types of competing Islamic authorities who want to have a greater say of what true Islam is, right? So what true Marxism is, you know, for different ideologies. So everybody's playing that game of having a greater power, having a greater position of authority to define what that true, you know, form of Islam is. When it comes to talking about Muslims in Europe, the very phrase is, of course, very misleading, because those Islamic authorities are there, but they have come, you know, have acquired that role as a result of this socio-economic context, the context of labor migration. Right, a particular group of people have arrived to Western Europe as a result of this migration, labor migration, largely rural socioeconomic status. But that's changing in generations, so their understandings of Islam is also changing. But the phrase Muslims in Europe is misleading because that gets to think us that it is as if it's a very recent phenomenon. Let's keep in mind, remind ourselves, and some, I do that to myself now and then, that you know, large communities of Muslims have been living on the European continent since the 8th century. Right? Think of Al-Andalus, think of the, you know, Ottomans, you know, of, beginning with the, you know, 14th century. So, and think of maybe close to 10 million indigenous Muslim population living in southeastern Europe, right? The Albanians, the Bosnians, and so on and so forth. So let's keep in mind that we are really talking about an immigrant origin, you know, Muslim population, let's say, in Western Europe. Having said that, that group really didn't define itself as primarily as Muslim to begin with. And here's a confession that comes out. You know, my father actually was one of the first immigrants, first to Germany and to the Netherlands. And he used to tell that in his time, in the late 60s, people have used this phrase, Islam Edirne'de kaldı. Islam is left back, behind, in Edirne, the westernmost border city of Turkey. So it's kind of like a drop it there. That is to say, nobody was talking about Islam, nobody was really practicing. So that was really the mood. And instead, it was this whole idea of being guest workers, like Gastarbeiters, as they were named. Thus, their the labor, for instance, labor unions were the most active organizations to organize their lives in the 60s and the 70s. And that started to change in the 80s and 90s because of family unification. In that time period, we start to see that the families are coming in, so institutions of religion and culture are being built. And then in that process, the same group of people now came to be referred to as Turks and Moroccans and Tunisians and so on and so forth. That is, ethnic origin was taking place instead of this kind of class-based definition of the same group of people. And we can say that by the year 2000s, we get to call the same group of people now by their religion. We call them Muslims. This overlap is very significant to understand the context of these Muslims, because religion is not their only or their primary identity, and at least not in all the acts they do. Thus, when you hear about, you know, Muslim youth rioting in France, as, you know, as it was called in 2005, you are really missing the point, because then people tend to think that it's really something to do with their religion. And of course, that's why they call these imams to tell these young, you know, French disenfranchised, you know, guys who are really unhappy with the French state to stop burning these cars, and they don't care. Of course they don't, because that's not, you know, religion doesn't play a role in that. It happens to be that these guys, you know, have origins or their generations in North Africa and other places. That's the connection. But that shift in the naming is pretty significant to understand the context of these group of people. The other important element of this context is this overlap of poverty, ethnicity, and religion. That is, the same group of people, you know, sharing low socioeconomic status, a particular ethnicity that's attributed to that group, be it Moroccan, Pakistani, or Turkish, as well as religion, Muslim. Because that equation is very difficult to break. And unless you break that, you can't really become full participant of a society. Just as a comparable example, you can think of the African-American population here, their socioeconomic status, and in terms of racial politics, and how it's so difficult to disentangle the two, both for the group, for the group of people, for the minority, as well as for the larger society. If you look at the numbers, I'm not going to go in that, you know, in detail, but since we're talking about Turkish Muslims, as you well know, more than two-thirds of the Muslims in Germany in particular are of Turkish origin, and in the Netherlands they are nearly, they are about half of all Muslims in the Netherlands, which is about to be 1 million. So these are the two countries I've looked at more greater depth. But one thing that is, I think, important to remind us is that Turkish Muslims are the largest group of Muslims that come from a single country in Western Europe. And I think it's understudied in that regard. We read a lot about, you know, Muslims from North African origin or Pakistani origin, let's say, living in different parts of Europe, but not as much work on the Turkish Muslims. And I think in terms of the query question in the beginning that I posed, how do Muslim actors engage with liberal democracy, Turkish Muslims could actually make an interesting case. So I think there is something that needs to be elaborated, and I think that's useful. The authorities that speak on behalf of Islam among the Turkish, let's say, origin Muslims living in Europe, we have various major groups of people that I have looked closely into. And I have grouped them as ideal types, if you will. The first group, official Islam, which is already described by Jonathan. So I'm not going to go into the details of that. The Diyanet or the Paris Mosque for Algerian Muslims, it's a tool of controlling or trying to control, let's say, this diaspora. And the type of Islam is largely focusing on ethical principles as well as ritual practice rather than any engagement with politics. So try to avoid it as much as you can. That's one of the principles. And trying to unite the nation through religion is the goal of this kind of official Islam. The second group I talk about is the traditionalists. Well, these could be groups such as the Tablighi Jamaat or the Süleymanlı, as they're also called Süleymancı. It's a Nakşi origin group that's very active among the Turkish Muslim community in Europe and elsewhere, including the U.S. So they do have several mosques as well. And in this approach, you know, you just accept the received tradition and do not question it, but just practice it and become better Muslims. That's the goal. So through Quranic courses, through, you know, invoking a more pious life, reminding, you know, Prophet Muhammad's life, that's a traditionalist approach. The third group, which could be called political Islamist, or at least in terms of their origins, we can think groups of Muslim Brotherhood, Milli Görüş, or Cemaat-i İslami. The original project of political Islamism was, of course, to some extent, change public life according to Islamic law. But what happened in time, both for these countries of origins and their original projects, where the original projects of Islamism has emerged, as well as, and certainly more, in their branches of these organizations in Europe, their goal has shifted, has changed. It has changed out of the reason that the people who live there started to have different priorities. Their goals are no longer changing politics in their countries of origin. Their goal is to give a better education to their, you know, to their next generation, and to get their Muslim identity accepted in the European public sphere. So those are become their priorities. The fourth group I talk about is referred to as civil Islam. This group, I think, is particularly important because new ideas could come out of practice of the activism of the groups within this category. And I put Gulen Movement in this group in particular, as well as certain Sufi organizations. Here, the goal is try to educate pious generations who are not avoiding modernity, but try to engage with it, especially in the educational field. So they are not like some Sufis, let's say, staying in their corners, but trying to change society by engaging with it. And that very process is actually transforming them. So that's the part, and I will give more examples on that. That's the civil Islam. There are civil Islamic movements in Indonesia, in other places, so the term has been used for explaining some of these movements. The last group is what I refer to as revolutionary. You have the Kaplan community or Kaplanjala, which used to be an active group in the 80s and 90s. Nowadays, you can think of groups such as Hizb ut-Tahrir or Salafi jihadist, whose goal are really bringing the religion and state together in a country, trying to make sure that they are combined, and use violence if necessary. So these are some of my categories and the groups that I've looked into. I'm not going to give all the numbers, but just to give you a sense, in Germany, for instance, if you look at Diyanet, close to 800 mosques, Milli Gurush, more than 300, close to maybe 350. The exact figures are in my book, as incidentally, you may want to look at it. Or the Süleymanlı, who have close to 300, the Gülen, about 200 institutions. And again, for the Gülen case, for instance, these are tutoring centers and schools rather than mosques. So they have a different type of organization. And the Kaplan community has been banned in 2001 in Germany. And I visited some of their ex-mosques. But they have disappeared, not really because they were banned, but they had already lost in the 1990s. The reason they lost is really at the heart of what I try to explain. And that is these Islamic communities, in Turkish they're called cemaats, if you'll, or movements, are in competition with one another to serve their constituencies, that is to try to get more followers to their movements. In order to do that, they compete with one another. So who is coming up with a, let's say, a project, a program that appeals to greater people? Well, that group actually picks up more followers. And they also have a relationship with the state, which was explained. So the state regulates, and they also want to be recognized by the state. So they have a relationship with the state, and while they're addressing the needs and concerns of Muslims in general, and they're negotiating in between these two groups while also competing with one another. So that's really the larger structure, what I call the structure of the Islamic field in Europe. Now, here I'm coming to the core of my argument. So what do I mean by localizing Islam in Europe? I'll just give three examples. The first one concerns state policies and Islam. My argument is that multicultural state policies facilitate localization of Islam. It causes Islam to be reinterpreted, to be adapted to the local conditions. The example I bring in is from Milli Görüş. When I compared Milli Görüş in Germany and in the Netherlands, I found that the Dutch Milli Görüş is much more willing to reconsider their positions and reinterpret some of the most contested questions, such as gender relations. The Dutch have promoted gender equality at housework. It was a large program under the Ministry of Social Affairs. And the Milli Görüş in the Netherlands wanted to participate in that, which they did. And they have come up with sermons. So in these sermons, and I've talked to the gentleman who has actually authored this sermon, which was delivered in the Friday sermons in all the mosques of Milli Görüş. In the sermon, it reminds the listeners, and this time you just imagine it's all men, largely women in Turkey often don't go to Friday prayers. So it's a group of men on a Friday where the sermon is talking and reminding them how Muhammad, Prophet of Islam, was mending his own clothes, was helping at housework, how just he was to his wives. And by reminding how a prophet as a model, right, for all Muslims, was living a life that promotes, let's say, gender equality at housework, the listeners are reminded how to actually act in their lives. This was a result of an interaction with the state, because the state promotes, right, and on the one hand, you know, this kind of project, but it also started to recognize Milli Görüş as a legitimate actor. You know, Milli Görüş, even today, for instance, in Germany, this is not the case, where Milli Görüş is still branded somewhat of an extremist, you know, of a group that is a threat to the constitution and so on. Whereas in the Netherlands, they used to do that in the late 1990s, but with this shift from, you know, with this change, let's say, in Dutch Milli Görüş, they're no longer there. So they're recognized now as a legitimate actor. So, of course, I've given you one example, but the examples can, you know, there's a long list of examples of how this interaction actually really plays itself out. So I'll be glad to take more questions on that if you like. The second major way in which this localization happens is through activism. Activities in the fields of community development, education, and public sphere make Islam more adaptive to local conditions. Here I want to bring an example from how interfaith dialogue activism can lead to pluralism, a more pluralistic understanding. One of the most leading activists in the Netherlands within the Gulen community there shared his views of how he changed in time through interfaith dialogue. He said, well, in the 1990s, my goal in engaging interfaith dialogue was to outreach to non-Muslims. That's the only way you can get in touch with non-Muslims. You know, you want to be able to share, right, your values, your beliefs. And this was a good strategy, if you will, to be able to do that. But he said, the more I talked to, you know, my interlocutors, the more I understood that we all want the same things. You know, we want justice. We want clean environment. We want to have peace in this world. So that kind of realization caused him to rethink his position. He said, well, you know, people are not, and they don't convert to Islam, let's say, because of the books you give or because of the ideas you tell them. But if you help them, you know, if they need anything, if you're there for them, that is to say, through this interpersonal relationship. And that relationship has caused him to rethink his justification for interfaith dialogue. So it's now no longer the differences of religion that is a reason to get together, but neighborly relations. So now he's justifying his goal to a bridging activity, to outreach out, you know, out of his community, you know, and to a non-Muslim larger society by saying, by reminding people that in Islam, going back to tradition, so the tradition is always part of this justification process, that, you know, having neighborly relations is a religious requirement. Prophet did that, regardless of the faith of your neighbor. You have to have good neighborly relations. So that justification sort of creates this spatial proximity, if you will, as a basis for interacting with the larger society. And as soon as I've listened all to that, I said, you should really write these down. I said, you know, as a scholar, you should write these down so everybody can read. And then he says, well, you see, people can only learn this by doing. They have to go through this process that I have gone through. So I think this process is really significant, that they transform themselves, you know, with that process. Third piece, Muslim integration. These various movements that I have looked into are not only doing bonding activities, you know, coming together, you know, education, Quranic schools, you know, socializing among themselves, but they're also doing bridging activities, outreach activities. That is, you know, when they come up with educational projects, they invite anyone, you know, that is to say, like tutoring centers. And such activities, again, you know, are making them much more connected to the larger part of the society. Young leadership is emerging out of this interaction. Young people are demanding to have their say in these activities, in these programs, they want to be recognized as the new leaders. Just with one example, I want to explain and then really conclude this process of localization, of rethinking Islamic tradition as a result of their presence and experience in these countries. The example comes from financial interest, riba. So in the Quran, it says, you know, financial interest taking or giving is prohibited. Well, it says riba is prohibited, but some people have interpreted it in this way. So then the question is, you see, in the 80s, none of these Islamic movements have permitted, if you will, have thought that getting a house with mortgage, with bank loan is allowed. None of them thought of it this way. But by the 1990s, that started to change, coincidentally, right? Because by the 1990s, people really wanted to come to realize that they're there for good, that they're going to be there for permanent, which means that you want to buy houses if you're going to live there, you know, for the rest of your life and for your children, right? So, of course, it's very difficult to see the causal relationship here, but which really caused the other. But these practical circumstances and this rethinking came at the same time, right? That now people are saying, well, it's really out of necessity, and then there are, of course, other reasonings as well through which they justify that if you want to buy a house through bank loan, it's allowed. Of course, there are other alternative systems, loaning systems and so on people have created, but this is now, for instance, in Milli Görüş Fatwa declarations. You can actually find it there. And I've actually talked to, you know, followers of other movements who share the same kind of approach now, that you can buy it in the 80s and people didn't, you know, were not allowed to do that. That's really the process in which this is happening. But it says, of course, there are challenges on the way. I can talk more about that in the QA. This whole issue of turning Muslims into a security problem due to global politics, the rise of far-right parties and their discourse turns Muslims into the other of Europe, and the revolutionary Islamists, especially the Salafist jihadists, who are really creating... who are marginal, less than 1%, but have a big public visibility. And also, my current work is about the growth of Salafism and its patterns and why it does not really pick up among the Turkish Muslims, whereas it's getting much more followers, let's say, among Moroccan Muslims, is some of the current research I'm doing. But so in order to answer the very first question we asked and conclude, how do Muslims, actors engage with liberal democracy? Well, in that process, through activism, what we find is that their understanding of Islam is incrementally adapting to liberal democracy in Europe. Thank you.